Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Freedom Nation podcast with Jeff here. Once again, I am leading off talking a little bit about new and interesting things. And today I've got Radhika Rastogi on, who has a very interesting investment philosophy that we're going to talk about. She is involved in the senior living space and syndications in that. So for those of you that don't know much about syndications, you'll learn a little bit about that today. And I think more importantly, you're going to learn a little bit more about senior living and why maybe it's an area if you're looking for passive income that you might consider. So stay tuned. We'll be right back on in just one second.
Welcome to the Freedom Nation Podcast with Jeff Kickle. On this show, Jeff shares his expertise in financial and retirement planning from a different perspective. Planning for your Freedom Day, which is the first day that you wake up and have enough income or assets and do not have to go to work that day. Learn how to calculate what you need, how to generate income sources, and listen to interviews from others who've done it themselves. Get ready to experience your own Freedom Day.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Radhika, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
It's just, I'm like, my brain is jumbled at this point. glad to have you on today. I'm looking forward to really, you know, getting into that, the senior living space and understanding that a little bit more and why it is a good opportunity. But before we get started, why don't you tell us your story? How did you get to where you're at today?
Absolutely. So I've spent a little over 12 years in healthcare consulting. That was working with Fortune 20 companies. These are like large health systems, payers, government entities. But for me, like my freedom moment, or when I like to say my reverse freedom moment, because it was the moment that everything changed for me, was when I actually was going back to work after having our second child. I was on bonding leave. I was going back to work. And 2 days before I was supposed to start, I got a text from one of my managers to tell me to travel cross country for a dinner. And that was, it was a very eye-opening moment, because it was the moment I realized I was building someone else's team, someone else's dream, working on someone else's schedule. And it was coming at the cost of my own family time. So with that moment, I just realized, like, I love real estate. I've been investing in real estate for over a decade. We were primarily doing residential at that time, but senior living kept pulling me in because it sat at the intersection of everything I already knew. It was healthcare operations, regulatory environments, care models. And that's what really led me to co-found Relic Capital Group with my partner, Vibha Salgame. And our goal is to acquire underperforming senior living communities that run like it's the 1990s, bring in operators who know how to turn them around and structure the deal so that our investors get their capital back by the end of year three and keep all of the upside.
Nice. Very cool. So what, you know, as I mean, was this something that now you've transitioned and you don't have a job anymore and this is what you do, or do you still have the gig and this is your side gig?
I like to say two big gigs. There's nothing side about the real estate stuff. No, I still have a W-2 and it's actually running in parallel. And that's, again, intentional because it allows me to get the financial runway while Relic continues to scale.
Yeah. Very cool. So let's talk a little bit about why senior living is a good area for investment. You know, if somebody's looking for passive income.
Yeah. I think the first big thing is that the demographics are there. So purely from like a market perspective, we're seeing that the oldest boomers are actually turning 80 this year.
Yeah.
And that means these are the people with the highest level of need, highest acuity. They're starting to enter the system at scale. And this wave is going to last about 15 years. So this is like the perfect time to get going.
Yeah.
And on the other side, from a supply standpoint, we're actually seeing the units under construction is the lowest since 2012. Yeah. So we're like in last year, 2025, there was something around 17,000 units nationally that got built. And so, you know, we're just not keeping pace. Like development would have to increase by almost four times to meet the need that's there.
Yeah.
And what I like that from an investment perspective is it just gives us pricing power, right? Like there's a clearly scarcity in the market. It allows us to charge, like rents are increasing, you know, 5 to 7% annually. And that allows us to provide a pretty solid return to investors. But I will say, like, on a more personal side, and the reason what really resonated with me in senior living, and I think when I had my first moment with an actual resident, it is really what drove me to really make this our entire mission, was this was one of our first communities we had acquired, and it was a memory care asset. We had a resident, he was 78 years old, he was an airline pilot. And our team members ended up getting him like this massive poster for his wall because he had not been talking. He had moved into the community a couple of weeks earlier. He wasn't really engaging with anybody. And so the poster was an inside of a 737 cockpit and it had every single like button and gauge and everything that was like lit up, right? And I got pictures of this where like he moved up to close to the wall where this poster was and he was just pressing on things. And that for me was really the ultimate, right? Like we can invest and we can make money and that's all great, but that's what really changed his life. And his you know, family came to visit a couple of weeks later and he was a different person. He was talking about stories that he hadn't talked about in years. And for me, like that movement was really what committed me towards this space specifically.
Yeah. No, that's a great story to have. What do you think, you know, based on, let's say, the current inventory here in the United States and the size of the baby boom generation, I mean, what is the need going to be over the next 15 to 20 years?
Yeah, from reports, it looks like there's almost a $300 billion investment gap. Yeah. So that's, you know, hundreds of thousands of units nationally. I would cautiously say that I think every market in the nation is under capacity.
Easily.
And, you know, again, like the easy part right now is finding the deals. The deals are all there. It's really just finding the operator who can actually turn them around and deliver to the returns.
Yeah. And I would assume, you know, the more efficient that you are, the better you're going to be in this situation where you can be hyper efficient with it and run it to where it's a, you know, it's a profitable investment for the investors. It's a good environment for the residents and everything else. So, you know, it's a combination of both when you're looking at it. It'd be my thought process.
Absolutely. And actually, I would say, you know, senior living, a lot of people are trying to get into it right now. And a lot of people with kind of a more traditional background, whether it's multifamily storage or something else. Mm-hmm. And something I like to just caution investors with is it's not actually real estate, right? You are buying a business, a healthcare business at that. It's wrapped into hospitality and real estate is just a wrapper. So be cautious of, you know, syndicators or investors who might be trying to get you into senior living who don't have the healthcare domain expertise to actually run the business because that is what's driving your entire investment.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it's also from a legal standpoint, it can get you in massive trouble.
Right.
If you don't do it right, it can get you in severe trouble with the state and the government, the federal government and everything else. Now, with senior communities, I mean, are you all running the gamut of, you know, like everything from like a senior living facility to, you know, the more advanced care levels, or are y'all kind of sitting on the front end of that spectrum?
Yeah. So the spectrum includes four types of communities, right? There's independent living, assisted living, memory care, and then right at, I would say, like the highest acuity, or essentially it's emergent care, which is skilled nursing.
Yep.
So we don't do any skilled nursing, but we will do the other three. Yep. And we try to be across the entire spectrum. So as the need changes, we want to have a community nearby that, you know, you can either just transfer right into or, you know, you're in one of our other communities.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. We've got one, I mean, literally like down the street from my house here. And, you know, we used to, they used to do like networking activities and stuff like that because they had the big community rooms. And theirs literally was like a, I guess, you know, if you had like three legs coming off of it, theirs was, you know, kind of the first wing was that assisted living, and then it became memory care. And then theirs was, you know, the skilled nursing care. So you kind of moved around that facility as they went.
Exactly.
You know, all within one. And, you know, with certain, it seemed like certain access levels for each, you know, it's like, okay, the memory care, well, we can't let them just wander around.
Right.
You know, we've got to kind of keep them penned in. And then, you know, when we're there, we can help them a little bit more. And of course, the skilled nursing, they typically maybe or maybe not ambulatory at that point.
That's exactly right. And and like we like to buy campuses like that too, because it's just easier for the families, easier for the residents. And, you know, instead of trying to uplift at 85 or 86 years old, like that's such a challenge.
Well, and I mean, you know, the friends that they develop there, I mean, all of a sudden now you're peeling them away to a whole different place, and, you know, not
exactly
not the way they would want it to be. So what do you, you know, typical from an investment, what typically, you know, when you're a syndicator, what is somebody looking at from an investment standpoint? You know, what should they expect from that type of investment, you know, as far as the payback schedule and things like that?
Mm-hmm. So most syndications, you know, minimum investment is anywhere between $50,000 to
$100,000. Okay.
Our minimum is usually $100,000, depending on the size of the deal. We like to structure our deals in such a way that essentially the LPs are de-risked first. So that's a big part of our thesis, is we want to get their principal out as soon as possible. So the splits, depending on the deal, could be anywhere between 60-40. So 60% of the deal goes to the passive investor, 40% stays with the GP. And then there's usually preferred equity as well. So this is, again, priority cash flow that you get before our GP team gets any dollars from the deal. Once that's concluded, then the GP gets part of the promote. So the thing that we do differently, again, I mentioned, is, you know, we want to do a refi by the end of year three, pull 100% of invested capital back out, and return that to the LP. At that point in time, you're still getting quarterly distributions, you're still receiving the upside from the sale. But what we have found is, when you return that initial capital and you're not waiting until year five, the investor is sleeping more peacefully. They're not thinking about the risk, right? You've essentially de-risked them, and everything else is upside. So, and I have found, because I've done this personally, is that's really how you compound wealth. So ideally, they take that money, redeploy it into another deal, and now you're just playing with the same money every three years instead of locking it in for 7 years or 5 years or however long your typical syndication is.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it's a much better compounding scenario too. If you can pull that out, get it working in something else. Okay. In 3 years now, I can roll that to another deal.
Exactly.
You know, and keep going from there. Now, when they, these are not eligible because of passive, they're not eligible for like a 1031 exchange or anything like that. You're going to have more capital.
Correct.
Yeah, you're going to have capital gains and dividends, or capital gains and tax.
We do work with, we do actually work with investors if they want to take their gains from like one of our deals into another one of our deals.
Okay.
We will help them through a 1031.
Okay.
We also have worked with like 1031s. If you have an investment property that's not a syndication and you're trying to get into a syndication, we'll help with that as well.
Nice.
So we try to think of creative ways to reduce the taxable gains there. And then we do provide depreciation. So ideally, even the passive cash flow that you are receiving through the duration of the deal, you know, those are coming in at losses, just for the passive income that you have, not against the W-2.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic, you know, especially for someone that's coming from the W-2 world and, you know, has maybe a high income, they don't need any more gains on top of it. So yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic way to defer those gains on, you know, and continue to let those grow over time. So yeah, outstanding. So what's, you know, we've talked about the good side. What's the bad side in these deals? What do people need to consider or be, you know, cautious of?
Yeah. The biggest thing, one you already mentioned, which was the legality. So lawsuits are prevalent. It is a healthcare business. Something that we do to protect LPs is they buy membership into the real estate, and there's a separate operating company that lives, well, separately, but there is like a lease agreement. So they still have stake in the OpCo, but they're completely protected from the legal implications of running the healthcare business. The second biggest risk is around staffing. So since COVID, staffing industry-wide has shifted. We're seeing just generally less caregivers. Uh-huh. Caregiver salaries are not increasing at the rate of cost of living. So finding good staff who are willing to do the emotional work, frankly, that's required to work with people one-on-one, the physical demands of that sort of a job, and to pay them at, you know, $16 or $17 an hour. I mean, that's like what you would pay a typical barista at a Starbucks. So you can imagine the type of work that they're doing demands more money. So something that we do to, again, work through that risk is we typically pay above market rate. Okay. We like, our operators are great with like creating the culture and actually having a career path. So it's not just that you come in as a caregiver, you stay as a caregiver forever. Mm-hmm. We create pathways to becoming a med tech or eventually getting into management. And that we have found is a great way to retain good people. So staffing, again, it's an industry-wide problem, but something that on a property by property basis, we're aiming to solve.
Well, and I mean, that's totally different from most of these facilities that are out there. I mean, most of the facility, it's just constant turnover of employees because, you know, like you said, they have no career path. It's like, okay, you're going to do this really hard, low paying job forever. And
exactly,
you've got no opportunity to make more money, do something different, you know, show your expertise over someone else's. There's no meritocracy. Yeah. You just keep grinding every day. You know, no wonder. Yeah, no wonder they have such a high turnover. And I think that's part of, you know, I guess, you know, from y'all's perspective, it is part of that whole, okay, we're trying to take companies out of the 90s, which that's the 90s model, to the way it is today.
Exactly. And I feel like we have actually surveyed one of our communities where, like, would you rather have $1 increase or $2 increase in your pay, or would you rather have like tuition reimbursement or a different kind of benefit plan, right? Mm-hmm. And most of the time, people actually don't choose the $1 pay increase. They actually would rather have tuition reimbursement, which is great to hear. And like, so we try to feel and curate benefits to the type of employees that we actually have in that sub-local market. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and like, again, it's good for residents too, right? They're not seeing people switch every time that's, you know, coming into their room. It's better for families. It helps us build trust with them, and also helps them recognize like, hey, this resident really loves apple juice. That's all they're going to get. And like these small things really make a difference in the type of experience we're providing for residents and families.
And like your first story with the airline pilot, I mean, that's just thinking outside the box, you know, hey, I wonder if we can find a picture of an airline cockpit, you know, who thinks of that? And, you know, but all of a sudden it's like, oh, let me tell you, I used to fly this plane. And, you know, all of a sudden, you're getting into something. And I saw this with my mother-in-law when she was, you know, slowly kind of going down the hill with dementia. I mean, she would go back to the stories that she loved over and over and over again, you know, and if you could get her talking on that, she was, you know, it was just animated and she would enjoy it, you know, instead of, okay, I really don't know who you are, but let me tell you this story about my life. And that's awesome. So what do you see? I mean, yes, you see the next 15 years of the movement of the baby boomers. And I mean, they've shaped everything in the world for the last 70 years. They basically shaped everything from Pampers to Disney World to everything else. I mean, they've just slowly been that that group that's, you know, 75 million strong, 70 to 70 million strong, that, you know, just keeps kind of moving through all the different phases. What do you see as kind of the future for that industry? How is it going to change?
Yeah, so I think the good news is, right, at least as of right now, no one has figured out how to stop aging. So I think the runway is still long. So even after, you know, Gen X is, they'll bring different, but still a substantial wave is still there. Mm-hmm. So even after baby boomers, there'll be Gen X's. That size is still pretty big. It's like 65 million people in the U.S. So I don't particularly think from a demand perspective we'll be having a problem. I think it will fall a little bit.
Yep.
I think the bigger risk right now is now, and I think will continue to be, is affordability. Mm-hmm. So, you know, boomers have done a good job of actually saving for retirement, I would say. About 50, 51% of boomers have, you know, $250,000 saved for retirement. Mm-hmm. But that tends to drop to about 30s for Gen Xers. And I think that's really the challenge is, okay, we don't know whether everyone's going to get Social Security. Not everyone purchases long-term care insurance. So that's going to be the harder part is there a cap at which point rates can increase, you know, and then if inflation continues to increase, what are the costs going to look like? So those are things, again, looking at kind of the 15 to 20 year horizon, we'll have to keep an eye on, but that demand is not really the problem.
Yeah. Well, to be a spoiler alert there, Social Security ain't going away.
Yeah.
Inflation's always going to be there. You know, those are the things that you can count on. Death and taxes will also be there. That the whole scare tactic from the government on, oh, you know, Social Security's going away and all that. They get to print money. So Social Security is never going away. I hate to tell you this. You might call it a Ponzi scheme, but they get to print money. So it's always going to be there. Yes, it's going to have to probably be adapted and changed a little bit, mainly because I think we're already seeing it with the baby boom generation. They're lasting a whole lot longer than I think they had originally thought that they would. You know, and I think every successive generation after that is going to continue to last a little bit longer. So we're all going to have to kind of build that in. I think, you know, your comment on long-term care, absolutely. If you don't have, if that's not part of your retirement strategy and plan, you better start thinking about it really quick. Because I'm assuming you see that, you know, people coming in where they have very little assets coming into it.
Yeah. And I mean, right now we're seeing the primary sources are either they just, you know, saved money. Yeah. Home equity is the other really big area. And most baby boomers do have quite a bit of equity in the homes that they're in. Long-term care insurance, which I mentioned, and Social Security. Sometimes they have a pension depending on what kind of job they had. So, and they might be picking from about five different income sources. But what I do think down the road, like, that will probably shorten to about three sources. And that's really when we're going to have to become more creative.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, with long-term care, you've got to have at least two activities of daily living that don't work. So that's not going to be in care. Or it won't be in that first level of care and, you know, maybe even not into the memory care. You know, that's going to be privately funded up until the point where you can't take care of yourself. You know, that's where your long-term care is going to kick in. So you've really got to kind of plan for those several layers, I would say.
Yeah. And I think, you know, something I was reading actually more about precision medicine a little while ago, like a week ago. And again, this is not going to change anything in the next, like, I think 15, 20 years. But if I had to live even longer than that, 40 years, 50 years down the road, if we could get to a place where people are living longer because you can target specifically any ailments that they have, essentially personalized medicine, right? I think the thesis would actually get stronger because I do, like, it's not like you'll just stop aging. You're still going to age, but your ailments will maybe not be so catastrophic. You might not die as early as people are right now. Mm. So if you could live to 100, 110, in my mind, that further elevates demand because you're still going to be in senior living. You're still going to need the support from family and from caregivers, but you're just, instead of staying there for 24 months or 36 months, you might stay there for 10 years.
Yeah.
And like that, again, from an affordability standpoint, that's another big window that we'd have to think through.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think more importantly, you know, from a planning standpoint, you've got to factor that in. I mean, where are you typically seeing like that first layer of care, the independent living side? What age group typically are you seeing that first like layer rolling in?
Usually around 60, 65. Okay. Now, there are like 55 and over communities. So a lot of people choose to go into those and they want to be surrounded by people of similar, you know, age, but also just activities. The independent living is much more amenity driven.
Yeah.
Right. So in assisted living, we're seeing closer to that 75-year-old range. And a memory care is 75 and up, just depends on
if you have an ailment. Yeah, at that
point, it could be earlier, really,
whenever it takes, you know, or whenever, whenever you start to see that or whatever, or you, it reaches a point where you can't, you know, handle it or family members can't handle it anymore at that point. And then you kind of give us a range there, but I mean, we could, you know, especially with Alzheimer's and other dementia related, I mean, that could be a 10, 12, 15 year ailment. Especially today, I mean, they're finding ways to make them last even longer in those cases.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would hope that for families, right, medicine gets even better where they could prevent Alzheimer's altogether or dementia. And, you know, then we, memory care will go down as a as demand, but perhaps that's where assisted living just takes a bigger share of the pie over time.
It's okay. I'm still getting older and can't, you know, or don't want to. I think that's the other part is people think, oh, you know, these folks are all, you know, to the point where, okay, they can't handle it. Some of them just don't want to, you know, you might have lost a spouse and, you know, I don't want to sit home and cook and everything else. I mean, I've been to, on Medicare appointments, been to multiple of these assisted, you know, living facilities. And it's like being at a resort. I mean, you know, I go inside and I'm like, I want to move in here, you know?
I've looked at a couple too and I'm like, this is not shabby at all.
Yeah,
I would love to live
here. I mean, the dining rooms are really nice and activities to do. And I mean, the apartments are reasonably nice. And, you know, I mean, it becomes... okay, at some point you just don't want to have to take care of a house and, you know, or be responsible for having to deal with all that or pay rent and have to deal with food and everything else. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, let's transition to the fast five questions now.
Sure.
All right. So first question, you wake up in the morning, business is gone. You've got $500 in your pocket, a laptop computer, a place to live, food and clothing, what are you going to do first?
Well, I'm not going to spend a dime on day one.
Okay.
I'll probably open up a Google Doc and start making a list of like 15, 20 people that are very close to me and they know what I can do. Mm-hmm. Like we've built trust. And I would ask them what they need.
Okay.
So what challenges are they encountering? Where do they need help? Only because like 500 nowadays can go a long-ish way with AI when you're building a business, but I still believe that relationships are really the brick builders.
I totally agree. Yeah.
I would think by the end of the week, once I've kind of had a, you know, quick chat with all of them, I'd be on the phone with operators, brokers, trying to figure out what deals they're seeing. And I would try to just structure a deal and I would use those 20 people and kind of that small and raise a friends and family around.
Right.
So not try to go raise something huge, but raise small amount of money, try to acquire an asset, run it well, start getting some cash flow.
I like it. I like that a lot. What's the biggest business mistake you've ever made?
Oh, I was thinking about this actually a little while ago. Biggest business mistake, and I did this actually because I had three other businesses I started before Relic. Number one mistake was not paying for proximity sooner.
Okay.
So on those businesses, I did everything myself. I figured out how to run the business. I learned everything, watched the, you know, read the books, watched YouTube, tried to grind through the day-to-day, but did not look for growing my network. And what I realized was I was kind of in that interesting phase of like bootstrapping, which was at the time, a couple of years ago, like very, very sexy. It was like what everybody did.
Oh, of course.
But what I found...
Hustle generation. Yeah, just hustle, hustle,
hustle.
Hustle
generation, yeah. but what I realized, and I realized it more when I started Relic, was I can't do that because my time is already significantly constrained and I can't pay in time anymore. So I, this time around, what I did was I found the best people, the top of their area, whether it's syndications, whether it's raising capital, whether it's whatever, I found those people and I paid to get close to them, to learn from them, because they've done what I'm trying to do hundreds of times over. And even like I found like even just one little nugget of knowledge from one of these kinds of people has significantly shifted our goals. With those three other businesses, I probably spent 3-4 years building those and made, you know, less than a couple hundred bucks a month.
Yeah.
18 months at Relic, we closed 17 million in transactions. Like, that was not, I didn't change, right? Like I just changed my strategy.
Sure. Well, and I think the reality is, you know, not only do you pay for the, you know, the closeness and the proximity, you also pay for learning about their mistakes that you don't make again.
Yes.
Even more than that, you know, the mistakes can be costly, but if you can pay somebody else to go, hey, don't do this.
Yeah, exactly. You're just saving on time. And, you know, the other thing I found that changed me by being in these communities was I was also surrounded by other people who were thinking like bold, and it allowed me to start thinking more boldly about what our goals could be. And pushed so much harder. And I think I really needed that for the timeline that I have set for myself for where I want to be.
Okay. Awesome. Very cool. What's a good book that you'd recommend for our audience?
Best book I've read is $100 Million Offers. It's by Alex Hormozi.
Yep.
It. I didn't have a lot of like sales training in my W-2. So, you know, sales is very new to me and something I'm still getting better at. Mm-hmm. But learning how to craft an offer that is irresistible, it's something every single business needs to learn how to do. Yep. And positioning yourself so you're not selling a commodity. Mm-hmm. Those were the two big things I learned from that book. And it was one of the best like values I've gotten out of the book.
Yeah, it was funny. I had, I think it was last year at Christmas time. So the previous year, 2024, my last interview on the show for the year. And I ask this question all the time, and I had never heard of Alex Hormozi. And the guy, I was like, well, you know, best book that you'd recommend for our audience. And I think it was Offers that, you know, he recommended. And I'm like, hadn't heard of the guy, you know, whatever. I didn't even look him up on YouTube or anything like that. And I bought the book. I think I read it in like 6 hours, the first book. And I'm like, what, where am I, what have I been missing this all along?
Yeah.
And, you know, that have since read the other two books. And just, I mean, it's an amazing, you know, if you have a great offer, you don't have to sell. You're not selling. You're just introducing an offer and saying, hey, here it is. If you want it, you know, you can have it. And, you know, for me, it changed my whole business model because I basically created, you know, in the financial planning space, well, you know, I'm the only one that does this. Nobody else does this. So if you want this, you've got to come to me. There is no other option. There isn't anybody else out there doing it the way I do it. Come to me, you know, and when that changed, everything changed. You know, for the business.
Yes.
So I love it. And I can see how you can use this, you know, in the money raise side and everything else. Okay, we've got a unique offering that is unique to us. You know, we don't do it the way everybody else does. And that's huge.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the best books.
Yep. Absolutely. And he writes well and he's funny. So, and if you can get past him on the internet, because he's goofy, but with the little nose things and the, if you don't know Alex Hormozi, look him up and you'll just see what I mean. He looks like a big caveman, which if you look at pictures of him from years ago, he didn't look like that. He does it specifically to look different. So you stop when you're scrolling and all that type of stuff, but he's a genius of kind of promotion.
He really is.
Yeah.
And he's so direct, which is another like
just no BS. Here's what
no
it is.
BS.
Do it this way. Yeah. I mean, and very genuine. I mean, I you know, he's not the bro, you know, the Lambo bros and everything else. He's no BS, and he makes more money than probably most of those idiots make. But you know, he doesn't really show it off or flaunt it. And he's just Alex, which is kind of cool. All right. What is a tool that you use in your business every day that you might recommend?
Oh, I use Claude every day. It's all AI.
Yeah.
We're putting an entire AI infrastructure under the business right now.
Nice.
And from everything from beginning the, you know, market analysis to, I would say, beginning underwriting. I don't actually let it underwrite the whole deal. Mm-hmm. To investor communications, content creation. There's so much we do. It's literally, I don't even think about it as a productivity tool. It really is like a thought leader in my pocket.
Yeah.
And I use it for everything. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And if you use it that way too, where it's, okay, you're almost going back and forth to say, okay, well, you know, and I will say Claude, I've used Claude to do writing, you know, and that's traditionally what it had been extremely good at. And I use different AIs for different purposes, but I will say just recently I used it to analyze another podcast and I was blown away. I was like, okay, I want to get to that success level. How did he do it? And it went back, you know, and then, okay, I want to do this with my own podcast or my own new show. And it was off the charts. Amazing when it came to its ability to do analysis, which it traditionally has not been, but this new version of Sonnet, the analysis side of it is really impressive from that perspective. Yeah.
Completely agree. I think the depth, like, it's actually been interesting. I've used it on some of my past acquisitions, so things we've already closed where we felt like we did a ton of great manual research, and it still found like certain regulations and update things that like we were like, oh, this is good to know, like still a good thing, but like good to know and keep in our arsenal for, you know, any new assets we buy in that location. So it's been fantastic.
Yeah, I'm very impressed. Like I said, it's just my newest book. I ran through that, and I've always used it as an editing tool. But I mean, it blew me away on that analysis. And I mean, even the prettiness of the analysis. I mean, it put it into, you know, ChatGPT will just jam a whole bunch of information on there, or Grok just kind of jams a bunch of the information. This thing came out where it was this beautiful layout and all this, and I'm like, okay, how do I get it out of there? It's in like HTML format. I put it in a PDF and it looked like crap, and I'm like, okay, I'll just look at it there because it's really pretty. Awesome. Last question for you. What is your definition of freedom?
It's being present with people that I love without asking others' permission. For me, like, especially while building a business right now, for me, that's like my 5 to 7 p.m. window. This is like my untouchable time where I don't work on anything. This is like my family time. We do dinner, dance parties. My kids are young. So they, you know, it's where we get to be goofy, and it's the best part of my day. And it's the non-negotiable that allows me to work the rest of the hours that I do.
Yeah. Well, and I'm assuming, you can protect that 5 to 7 period, and then the kids are going off to bed and you can do a little bit of work in the back end and that. Yeah. And that says to me a lot about you of, I protect this time. This is my, you know, this is our time, and we don't, you know, nothing invades that. We do the fun stuff during that time period. And it's going to be that'll be the thing, you know, when your kids are in their 30s. That they'll look back on and go, wait, man, we always had fun, like from 5 to 7, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I made a like promise, I think, to myself when we started, that if it meant that our business would be a little bit slower like based on goals, but I got that and I got our 2 hours every day plus like the weekends and whatever.
Yeah.
That is such a good trade-off, right? Like
absolutely.
I can be present with my children, with my partner and still build something that's wildly successful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sign me up.
Yeah.
It was a good trade-off.
Yeah. Love it. Fantastic. Great answer too. Well, if somebody is interested in learning more, what's the best place to go to learn about, you know, the deals that you're doing, what you've got going on, all that kind of good stuff?
Yeah, the easiest way is to come to our website. So that's okay. RelicCapitalGroup.com. That's R-E-L-I-K, capital, C-A-P-I-T-A-L, group.com. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got a ton of educational content up there. We are very education first, investment second. Mm. The second best place is to find me on LinkedIn. I'm very active. And nice. Again, I post regularly about senior living, but also lessons from deals we're evaluating and the journey of building a business, working a W-2 and raising a family.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Just fantastic answers to the questions. So
thank you.
Look forward to catching up with you. I'll make sure I connect with you on LinkedIn so that we can stay in touch. And everybody, please reach out, touch. We've got in the show notes page, we'll have the link to the website and everything else. And as always, make sure you subscribe to the channel. Make sure you hit that little up arrow that tells you when our new shows are coming out. And as always, if you have questions, just share them in the comments and we will get back with you. So thanks a lot. And we will see you guys back here the very next time.
Thank you for listening to the Freedom Nation Podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and all the major channels. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe to the channel and leave a rating and review. If you have friends and family that could benefit from their own Freedom Day, please share with them. Finally, join Freedom Nation by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.